thank you very much. Well, it's great to have James Carey with us. How do you describe yourself if you're introducing yourself to strangers who are soon to be friends? But how do you say what you do?
Oh, friends, that's a fighting talk. How do I describe this? I tend to say that I'm a writer, even though I mostly write half-hour situation comedy. I was one of the writers in the first two series of Miranda. And then on Miranda, I met a guy called Richard, and we ended up writing a show for BBC Three that you won't have seen called Bluestone 4-2.
There are people here who have seen that. We know.
It's now on Netflix, by the way. So people just it's on Netflix. Oh, excellent. It's just like, yeah, it was on the BBC, and the BBC were there first. Somehow Netflix has sort of surpassed the BBC. Before all of that, I used to write a lot of radio comedy with Milton Jones. I still work with Milton, and sitcoms and that kind of thing, and sketches and other stuff. So I've been getting away with it for 15 years or so, and I'm not. I think everyone gets this thing. I think you get it in every line of work. It's a thing called imposter syndrome.
Yes. Yeah,
I get that too, where at some point I'm still expecting someone to tap me on the shoulder. Maybe this is it. Maybe this is an intervention.
Yeah.
And just to say, this whole comedy thing.
It's gone on long enough.
Let's be honest. Yeah. It's gone on long enough. We love you. We think you should stop. Now go and work on a dairy farm like your father did.
Yes.
So that's, I'm a writer. That was probably a longer, I should have just said writer, and then we could have moved on.
Yes, you're a writer. Okay, great. And you've always loved comedy. That's always been your thing.
Yeah, it's comedy. I don't really write. I admire drama, and I like Line of Duty as much as The Next Man, which seems to be quite a lot. For me, one of the reasons I'm a writer is that I love comedy. And growing up, I just used to watch comedy. I only ever wanted to watch comedy. It's the main reason that I hate dancing. and the reason for that, it'll make sense in a moment. There wasn't that much stand-up comedy on television 20, 30 years ago, but there were Royal Variety shows, and they always had comedians on, and I was always very excited about this. So I would sit there waiting for a comedian to come on, and then Jimmy Tarbuck, who was presenting it, or whoever it was, would say, and now, please would you welcome... Hot Shoes. Oh, it's dancers. Oh, I've got to wait another 6 minutes before there's comedy. I have to fight that whenever I had to go and see my children do dancing, that I don't have that visceral reaction of, oh, this is so boring and not funny. What's the point of it?
Yes. You take your children to comedy class.
Yes,
instead,
exactly. Yes, that's right. I take them to comedy store. And that's also why I hate horse racing, is because... growing up, I used to love watching cricket and still do, but the BBC always used to cut to Haydock Park for the horse racing. Yeah. And for me, horse racing is an absence of cricket.
Yes.
Why would you want that?
What else do you hate, James, while we're at it?
Dancing, horse racing, jogging. There's a long list we could do, but I feel this will be a sidetrack. This is turning into more of an intervention than I thought. But I feel terrific, so thank you for this.
Well, okay, but particularly...
This is apple juice and not whiskey, in case you're wondering. Although now you think it is whiskey, I've drawn too much attention to it.
And it hasn't always been the stand-up that you've loved. It's particularly the sitcom format is what you love. You're on Twitter as Sitcom Geek. Your blog is Sitcom Geek. You've got a podcast called...
Sitcom Geeks.
Sitcom Geeks, yes.
I'm a geek about sitcom. I've always loved half-hour comedy probably more than anything else. And as I've gotten older, I used to love sort of all comedy, but as you get a bit older, the sketch comedy stuff tends to fall away a bit, and you become more interested in characters and story and that kind of thing. So that's what I've ended up doing. In fact, quite often, I think when you're in your teens and your 20s, you tend to have ideas and jokes and things like that which lend themselves to 2 or 3 minute sketches. But as you get older, you start to understand more about the complexities of life, and you start to see things from different perspectives slightly better, and therefore you're able to write situation comedy where every character has a different perspective. And so when I have somebody come up to me age 21 to say, oh, how do I write a sitcom? My main piece of advice is be older. Don't be 21. Be 35, and then you know, and then you'll start. In fact, if you're writing a novel, if you're under 40, you are technically a young novelist. Mm. So there is hope for any people in their 30s if you want to be classified as young. I'm 41 now. It's too late for me.
Mm. Or move to Eastbourne.
Where
you can be a young man long into your 50s.
That's why you're there. Yeah. That's why you're living the dream. So half-hour comedy is you know, I grew up watching Porridge and Yes, Prime Minister and Allo, Allo and... Mm. All those sorts of shows.
What's the ideal sitcom? Like, has there got to be an arc, and has there got to be character development within the 28 minutes? And
yeah, it's always. I mean, actually, I mean, this kind of tangentially comes onto why I love sitcom more than why I like writing it, because you know, people sort of say to me, you know, what kind of a job is that? But also, as a Christian, you know. Haven't you got better things to do with your time than write situation comedy? But for me, what I love about sitcoms is it is actually a really good description of life. Mm. Now, although that sounds ridiculous, because Allo, Allo, for example, is not a terribly good description of life. But what sitcoms do is everybody, you know, every character pretty much behaves the same way each time, each episode. The characters don't change. Mm. And they kind of, you kind of know what they're going to do before they've done it. And if I sort of say, Captain Mannering, Del Boy, the Vicar of Dibley, Victor Meldrew, you can picture these people exactly, and you know how they would behave in any given situation. And life is like that. And that's why that's why sitcom is realistic. It's because, you know, if your mum phones you up and asks you a question, you know what she's going to ask before she even asked it. The phone rings, you know who it is. That's, you know, life is a sitcom. You just end up doing the same thing week after week and just having the same conversations with the people around you, like going, how are we talking about this again? And it always ends the same way, and he always runs out, and she always cries, and he always does that. He always comes in. You know, our lives feel kind of sitcom-y.
Yeah.
And so I think in one sense, situation comedy is a really good experience of life, which I think is why, and obviously it's very compressed and very heightened and all that kind of stuff. So you do need a story there. But also, the story within the sitcom is really important too. It's not just the characters. The story, sitcom is a Christian form of entertainment. I know it sounds kind of crazy, but it is a very moral form of entertainment, because if your character tells a lie, if Miranda covers something up in the first 2 or 3 minutes, starts telling a lie, she needs to tell a bigger one and a bigger one and a bigger one, we know that the truth is going to come out. If a character is mean to someone, if somebody is being rude to someone, if someone is being proud, they are going to be exposed, humbled, or something. We know. And imagine if that didn't happen in a sitcom. Imagine if your main character went on this great long quest and stole something from one of the other characters.
Yes.
And at the end, I got away with it.
Yes.
Undetected.
Like Dexter, the serial killer, who
Absolutely.
Just keeps getting away with it.
Yeah,
but that's
yeah,
not
yeah.
a comedy.
It's not a comedy. No. But you know, the credits start to roll, and you go, "What's that? What? Mm. How? You know?" Or there's about to be a great big climax to a story. And then it rains and everybody runs inside. Now, that's what happens in real life, funnily enough. This is where it doesn't quite match. But every single action in a sitcom has to be earned or deserved. And it feels like that we are telling a story, because we in our hearts know that lies will be exposed. Mm. We in our hearts know that the proud should be humbled. And we want to see that.
Yes.
We want to see that.
And it's funny when they slip on the banana peel.
And it's funny when they slip. It's funny when they get what they deserve. It's satisfying. It's sort of more than funny. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of why a good sitcom, when it's working, tends to have those things in it without us realizing it. We just remember Del Boy falling through the bar, and that's great. But actually, there are loads of things going on there. But yeah, it's kind of the repetitiveness of the characters, but also it's the underlying morality, because the universe is, despite what we are often told, the universe is not a series of accidents. Our lives are not a series of random encounters. Mm. There is meaning to it. Mm. And every episode of a sitcom reinforces that, and therefore I'm very happy to be part of that, when actually the media are telling us quite a lot of other messages and just saying, oh, we're all just molecules, nothing matters, nothing makes any sense. And that isn't true, and sitcoms prove it.
So comedy is not frivolous, and it's not simply about making light of stuff. It's actually tapping into something very real, very honest.
Yeah. Even Mrs. Brown's Boys. I know that sounds crazy, but that gets a lot of viewers, and it is a bloke in a dress. And he does say to the audience...
Wait a minute.
Hang on. I mean, there's a bit where the audience all go, something bad happens, and everyone goes, And she looks straight down the camera and just says, I'm a bloke in a dress, as if telling the audience off for finding it sad. Mm-hmm. But even that, the audience engage with it, because that's a story about a mother and her children, and that's a very powerful story. It's Bread. Remember the sitcom Bread, set in Liverpool by Carla Lane? It's the same show. It's just it's a bloke in a dress. Mm. But we want to be attached to these characters. We want to identify with them. We want to. They're all about these things, even though on the surface they are just a bloke in a dress doing some jokes.
Yeah. And there's a joy to the recognition of that. That's why there's such a thing as observational comedy.
Yeah, exactly.
You're observing it, and ha ha.
Yeah, there's a recognition to it as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So life in your home wasn't.
Oh, it's hilarious. Life in my home. No. Go on.
Growing up, it wasn't entirely just memorizing Yes Minister scripts.
It was mostly that.
It was mostly that.
But I have three older sisters, and we grew up on a dairy farm. In general, I have very fond memories of it. There was a bit for about a week. I thought maybe I'll be a dairy farmer, and then I thought, let's get a job that's mainly indoors.
I have to get up when?
Yes, My dad got up every day that early, and he never got used to it. He never liked it. In one sense, he was not suited to being a dairy farmer. But
like how early? Like.
No, it's not too bad. And to be honest, I mean, people do sort of make jokes about that. But there are people who live in Maidenhead who have to be in the office by 8, and they're getting on train at 7, so they're getting up at 6. You know, my dad was only getting up at 6. He had to milk 100 cows, for goodness sake. How hard can that be?
But it wasn't for you. It
was not for me. No.
Was it a Christian home, a church-going home, a faith-filled home?
It wasn't an anti-Christian home. It was not a hostile to faith home, but it was a British home where we tend not to talk about our feelings. We don't try to have arguments. Have them in your head afterwards, but don't have them in front of them. And you don't really discuss religion in any meaningful way. I don't think I've spoken to my parents about Christian faith and Jesus more than 2 or 3 times in my life, and I'm 41. So it's not something that comes naturally to them. Through God's grace, or dumb luck, depending on your theology, they sent me to a ludicrously Christian school called Monkton Coombe.
That's actually on the sign outside.
Ludicrously Christian.
That's right. Since 1312.
Right. Yeah. £1,000 a year. Ludicrously Christian. And through that school, I just heard there were lots of Christian staff, and I just heard Christianity just presented in a normal, understandable, relatable way. I heard about Jesus. I heard about, we had chapel, and it just everything was just kind of presented in a very easy and friendly way. And by the time I was 10 or 11, I just thought, this kind of makes sense. And I think the Christian worldview is consistent. I think it works. I think that lots of people out there think it doesn't work or don't want to live this way. I think that I do. It was a very compelling conversion, as you can hear. It was really quite blinding lights. But I just realized that this is true. I think.
And when you say this,
you
mean, okay, God's there.
Yeah.
We've turned our back on him.
Yeah.
Jesus has come, sorted us out.
Yeah. I think for me it was I think it was generally that which made me think maybe there's something in this. I think the thing that for me made a difference was I didn't understand how Jesus dying on a cross made any difference, and it was only when I understood that he lived the perfect life, and he takes my place on the cross. He dies on the cross when actually I'm the one that deserves to die on the cross. And so, and he's raised to life, and I'm raised with him, and I can enjoy eternity forever with him. Even though I'm going to die, we'll be raised and go to be with God forever. Once I kind of realized that's kind of the mechanism, that's how it worked, I think that was the thing that made me think. In one sense, at that point, it stopped being a mystery. I sort of understood, oh, that's how it works. And I thought, yeah, I'll go for that. And I've been going for that kind of ever since, really.
Fantastic. And this Monkton Combe School is the school that James Schoen was a teacher at, who we had here yesterday, and who he was going to be the...
It's a racket we've got going. A Christian racket.
Yeah. No, a school with great foundations. It's produced many great people, so...
Yeah. Yeah.
With some exceptions.
Yes, exactly.
So from there, you go from, in one sense, a childhood faith, because you were...
I was a child.
You were a child and you had faith. But then you leave to go to Durham University to...
Yes,
study.
I went. So I applied to Cambridge.
Yeah. Which college were you rejected from?
So I applied to Corpus Christi to do history, and I was unsuccessful in my application. And then the second year, I applied to do theology at Trinity, because I thought, I'm just going to go to the most famous college with all of the famous alumni. And I was unsuccessful in that application. And so I went, like many people in that situation, to the University of Durham, and I had a great time. It was really good. I only wanted to go to Cambridge because of the heritage of the footlights. Actually, it wasn't the academic stuff or anything like that. Mm. It was the fact that half of the Pythons had gone there, and you know they had a real heritage of comedy. But actually at Durham, through dumb luck, I didn't know this at the time, they had their own sort of comedy review, and so I started getting involved with that. Actually, if I had got into Cambridge, I'd have been there with Mitchell and Webb and those sorts of guys. And it would have been quite competitive, because they're really funny.
They're all right.
I didn't have to compete with them.
Hmm.
I had to compete with the rejects like me. So, I got experience of writing comedy as well as... I did a degree. Yeah, I did a theology degree.
That's how I think about my first degree as well. Right. Yeah, yeah. In theology, so academic theology, how does that match up with a childhood faith? Were there any faith wobbles as you investigate further?
Not really. I mean, I do remember thinking, if this Christianity is sort of not really true, I'm probably going to find that out in the next 3 years. And I never really encountered anything that I felt was really worrying or shaking my faith. I found that there are lots of alternative explanations for the New Testament documents and for this, that, and the other. I didn't find many of them convincing. The theology degree itself wasn't really trying to shake your faith particularly, but lots of people on my course were not Christians and didn't have an axe to grind, or at least the same axe to grind that I had. Everyone's got an axe to grind. Over the course of 3 years, I studied... I tried to repeat as much of the stuff I'd learned in my A-levels as possible so I could spend less time studying theology and more time writing comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And that worked out quite well. And I managed to escape after 3 years with a degree in theology. And my Christian faith was actually, enhanced through that. And
And what do you do with a theology degree from Durham?
Oh, well, the world is your oyster. With that theology degree from Durham...
You could be a dairy farmer.
I could be a dairy farmer. I could work for Procter & Gamble. They recruited heavily from there. Ernst & Young were heavy recruiters from there. So I could have been an accountant. I could have been a product manager for Ernst & Young. I could have been, they're all kinds of things. But actually, and to see what I did, I actually applied for a job in advertising. Because 20 years ago, you just didn't know anyone who was a writer. It wasn't a thing. Like it is now. I think in the Guardian newspaper, there was a poll about what would be your ideal job. And the most popular ideal job was being a novelist or a writer or something.
Because they seem such emotionally balanced people.
Yes, that's right. Well, because it seems like they don't do any work.
Yeah.
And that money just kind of arrives somehow. Mm. But that kind of culture of being a writer, and and these days everyone's a writer and blogging and social media and stuff, that wasn't the case 20 years ago before the internet. I know, there was a time there wasn't an internet. It's called most of human history. And I didn't really know. So I just applied for jobs, and I didn't really get them because I didn't really want them. I didn't want to do them. And I applied for a job in for an advertising agency, I think. And when and obviously in interviews, there were no right or wrong answers. But when they ask you, where do you see yourself in 5 years' time? And the answer is writing a sitcom for BBC One. That's the wrong answer. That's the wrong answer. They would like you to imagine you are still working in advertising in 5 years' time, ideally for them. But I was not clever enough. So I was unsuccessful in my attempt to get a job in advertising. And I'd heard about there were opportunities to do comedy writing for Radio 4, a show a long time ago called Weekending, which was like that anyone could kind of turn up and write for. So through that and a few other bits and pieces, and I'd already got experience at university. I then got back together with some uni friends. We did some shows at the Edinburgh Fringe and stuff, and you know, it just sort of started to go.
And so you've never really had a proper job?
I've never really had a proper job.
Fantastic.
That's right. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Proper jobs are very much overrated.
Yeah. So, okay, so comedy. Let's lift the lid of the black box and look into comedy and spoil it for everybody, because as soon as you explain a joke, you've killed it. So why does comedy work? What is funny about funny? What are we responding to in comedy?
I think it's an element of that recognition that we were talking about earlier. I don't know. If anyone really knew, they'd be a zillionaire. They'd have a show that's even more popular than Mrs. Brown's Boys. Hmm. I think there's an element of it's always subversion of the normal. So you have to, you know, every joke has a setup of any, you know, whatever it is. There's a setup. You're establishing normality, and then you have the twist on it. Then you have the subversion, the surprise. And that's when it obviously, even then, it starts to go wrong, because it stops being a surprise and becomes a shock. And actually, we don't want a shock. We'd like a surprise. And at that point, comedy starts to career off into tragedy, horror, offence, all these sorts of other things, really. That's kind of the basics of it. I mean, there is a book. I don't really know what comedy is. I don't think any of us do, and anyone who claims to is probably lying. But I do know there's a lovely quote from Ken Dodd, who is still alive, and I have seen him live. Mm-hmm. And he did go, he didn't finish the gig till 12:45 at night.
Wow.
Started at 7:30.
Wow.
He is famous for going on all night.
Yeah.
He famously said, Ken Dodd says, Sigmund Freud says that comedy is a release of psychic energy. But then Sigmund Freud's never had to do the second house of the Glasgow Empire on a Friday night. So I think all of these academic theories are fine, but actually when you're out there playing a crowd at that point, you're going to find out what comedy is pretty fast or not.
Yes.
It is kind of sink or swim, really. So the answer is, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry about that. And if I did know, I wouldn't tell you. You'll take
trade
my
secret.
Job. Yeah, that's
trade
right.
Trade secret. And do Christians come up to you and say, come on, James? I mean, they might come up and say, look, this is a frivolous waste of time because you're just making light of stuff.
Yeah.
Or they might come and say, well, you're just making fun of people.
Yeah.
And that's not very nice.
Yeah.
Like, or they might say, what about blasphemy?
Yeah.
You know.
Or swearing. Yeah.
Yes.
So I wrote this show called Bluestone 4-2. I wrote is set in the army, and I don't know if you've noticed this, but soldiers don't talk like I do, and they use words that I do not use. Hmm. My mother was appalled by the content of the show. Hmm. I didn't spend all that money on your education for you to write that, but she was secretly quite proud. So I think we have to balance quite a few things here, because I think sometimes it's easy to think, well, if you're a Christian, you are just relentlessly positive all the time about everything, and that therefore you shouldn't be mean, or you shouldn't criticize, or you shouldn't do any of these things. And you know, this stuff doesn't hold up for long when you think about it for more than a split second, which most people don't, because they have no need to, and that's fine. But I kind of get it all the time, so I've had to think about it. I mean, firstly, Jesus didn't talk that way. So Jesus deliberately offended people. mainly religious people who are very easily offended, and so therefore it's always religious people who have a go at you. It's never anybody else, by and large. He intentionally, he called them names. He called them vipers, whitewashed tombs. He called them really humiliating things. He wasn't even being satirical. He was just calling them names. Mm. He would impersonate people, I think, as well, when he was saying, you know, the people on the street corners, they sort of contort their faces. And you can imagine him doing a Pharisee impersonation.
That's right.
And everyone would kind of recognize it.
And all the Pharisees go, are you doing me?
Yeah, are you doing it? Is he being me? Oh, man, hey, mate, that is so you. You pray just like that.
Yeah, that's right.
So I think you would kind of get some of that. It doesn't really come across in the Bible because the Bible is a long book. It is a book that is not really read, is often read, that our culture doesn't really listen to anymore. It's about as funny as Shakespeare. And for most people, Shakespeare isn't funny either. And that if you're in an English class being taught that Shakespeare is funny, you kind of write on a note, at this point, Shakespeare is making a joke. whilst your English teacher is standing there going, come on, guys, it's funny. It's funny that this has happened, you know.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, a lot of biblical humor comes across like that, just because we don't know our Bibles, we don't know the culture. So firstly, the Bible uses comedy. And in fact, some of the things that Jesus says are very hard to understand unless you assume that he's actually joking or saying the opposite for effect or hyperbole or exaggeration. Firstly that. And secondly, as a Christian and as an artist, as a writer, I use the word artist about myself then. Thank you for not laughing. But as a Christian and as a writer.
As a creative.
As a creative. I feel very strongly that I have to, I want to tell the truth. And that's what Christians have to do. That's what I want to do. I have to tell the truth. Mm. Here's the truth. If an IED explodes near you, if you're in Afghanistan, you're trying to render a bomb safe and it blows up, you don't say, oh dear. Mm-hmm. And certainly no soldiers I know would say, oh dear, let's go over there. They would use other words. And so what you need to do is reflect the world as it is, not as the world as we'd like it to be. Again, Jesus does that in parables. He tells the story, the most famous parable of the Good Samaritan. A guy is beaten senseless and robbed. Jesus, I don't think we need to hear stories like that. Thank you. That's not appropriate. Could you please make a story with a happy middle and a happy beginning and a happy ending, please? He doesn't tell stories like that. He tells stories that are of as life as it is. That's what I love about the Bible. The Bible is about the whole of life. It's about every stage of life. It's about the good times and the bad times and terrible people doing terrible things to each other in the Bible. Just as today, terrible people are doing terrible things to each other. And a book that wasn't like that, we would be rightly suspicious of, and it would feel like a cult, which Christianity is not. I want to tell the truth when I'm writing. I want to show the world as it is, and otherwise I'm lying. Which is also something I don't really want to be doing. So, and I think if soldiers use, if I write soldiers saying big sweary words and you're offended by that, great. Be offended. That's fine. You haven't committed a sin by being offended. I'd be more worried if you weren't offended because I don't think people should talk like that, although I understand when they do. So I think being offended is fine. There's a stand-up comedian called Steve Hughes, who's an Australian, and he says, you know, he's got a bit about talking about how when someone just says, I was offended. I'm going to do my Australian accent now.
Go on.
I was offended by what you
said.
Are you
doing me?
I was offended. So are you. I was offended by what he says. When you're offended, nothing happens. Nothing happens. So I think people kind of maybe expect things to happen when they're offended. As if I am automatically wrong for having offended someone. And actually, the offense is a very poor way of measuring whether someone was right to say a joke or not. It may be that joke is very difficult for you to hear because of a personal situation. Well, they didn't know that. It's not their fault. And that's why you need grace. That's why you need to understand the context and the situation. And So yeah, so that's kind of, so those are the things I have to think about when I'm writing. And there are certain things that I would write about, certain things I wouldn't write about. I tended not to have soldiers blaspheming, but I tended to be fairly happy with them swearing, so I tried to not write blasphemy as a personal thing that I just didn't really particularly want to do. But my co-writer, who's not a Christian, he wrote those. I was not overall in charge of the show, so it's a bit of a give and take.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the kind of issues that kind of swirl around when I'm thinking about how am I writing. But as a writer, I have a lot of freedom to write the things that I like to write. And as I say, sitcom is in itself a positive thing, because it is about what life is really about. And it is about the fact that the universe is not an accident, and our lives are not a random series of events. A sitcom where random things happen for 28 minutes is not a rewarding watch.
Mm. That's theatre of the absurd.
That's theatre of the absurd.
Which is not funny.
Which is not funny. It's kind of like an independent film, really. I'm kind of glad that it's there to prove that the mainstream stuff is actually more enjoyable. Yeah. But I'm unlikely to make an art house movie. I think you're probably sensing that.
And would you go so far as to say that the Bible is itself comedic?
Yeah, in the sense of the Bible is, there is a happy ending. The Bible is something that brings joy, even though it's hard to read. The way in which things work, so, you know, when Jesus is, even on Good Friday, that we've been thinking about obviously recently, that is in itself a comedic event. The idea that God becomes a man is absurd.
Mm.
And yet it happened. And that's something that other religions cannot understand. To a Muslim, this is the most offensive and odd thing. Mm. How can God become a man? Yeah. That's
God got acne?
Yeah.
God got acne.
Yeah, that's right. He had a beard, and he did the things that we do, and he ate, and he, it's offensive, and it's strange, and it's wrong. But the big joke is, so God became a man. Oh, great. How did it go? Well, you're never going to believe this, but they killed him. Oh, right. Okay. Did he raise people from the dead? Yeah, they did. And then they decided that that's one of my favorite bits. When Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead, some people see this and they go back to the temple and say, he's just raised this guy called Lazarus from the dead. And they say, oh, we're going to have to kill him now.
Yeah, yeah.
And they go, no, I don't think that's going to work. Yeah. I think, you know, if there's not, my other thing I think about the Lazarus story is the idea when he stands at the tomb and says, Lazarus, come out, he has to say the name Lazarus because he's so powerful that if he just said, come out, they would all come out. All the dead bodies would come
not
out.
Not you, not you.
Back in,
you.
Back in.
Yeah.
But the idea that Jesus is, you know, he's the most wonderful person who ever lived, and we hated him. And we killed him. Mm. Oh, so who killed him? Was it really bad people? No, it was the religious people.
Yeah.
It was the priests. They voted for it. It's incredible. It's funny.
Deeply ironic.
Ironic. I wouldn't open with this at the Comedy Store. You know, it's not comedy gold.
Yeah.
But the way it works, it's absurd. I mean, God's promises in the Old Testament, God speaks to Abraham and says, you're going to have a child. And Abraham's like, you know, 90, and his wife is 90, and she laughs. And he says, why is that funny? Because I'm 90. I'm not going to have a child age 90. And she kind of does, in fact. You know, it's...
It's subversion.
It's an old lady has a child. It's a virgin has a child. Mm. It is Gideon, the weakest... most pathetic member, when God says, I'd like you to save Israel, you know, you're going to fight a mighty battle. And Gideon's there is like going, you've totally got the wrong guy. I'm from the weakest tribe. Yeah. I think I'm going down with something. And I don't think that is God. I think you're something I ate. He starts putting God to the test. Yeah. Moses,
right? Yeah.
I'd like to send you to Egypt. Nah, you're all right.
Yeah.
No, I'm going to send you. Nah, send someone else.
But my brother.
Yeah, send my brother. Yeah. I can't speak. I'm very bad. Dry up.
I get tongue-tied.
This is just awful. So the Bible is full of these kind of unlikely
David
heroes,
and Goliath,
unlikely people. And God uses them so that people will see that it's obviously God and not this idiot.
Right.
That he's just plucked out of nowhere.
Right.
He's got no talent or anything like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that's us. We're idiots.
Yes. And that's where
why
the comedy.
We love comedy.
Yes.
Because Captain Mannering, he's an idiot. He's lovely. He's brave. He's loyal. But he's an idiot.
Yeah.
Faulty is an idiot.
Yeah.
They're idiots.
Homer Simpson.
But they're us.
Yeah.
Homer Simpson's an idiot.
Yeah.
Peter Griffin's an idiot.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we love them because we're idiots.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the sad truth.
Yeah.
So this is now an intervention for you. You're all idiots. And so am I.
Yeah. Exactly. And it's that sense of you can take God seriously, but you take yourself not seriously when you come to understand this truth. And there's the comedy. So let's round off with a couple of questions, but what about being a Christian in your particular workplace?
Yep.
Because you're a rare breed. Among, I don't know, those at the BBC, those working in media, those creatives, they know you're a Christian? And if so, how?
I don't make any secret of my Christian faith. I very rarely asked about it. People would really rather I didn't talk about it. They don't want to know about it. I think they find it. I've experienced very little hostility. I've been the victim of evangelism in terms of atheist evangelism.
Sure.
I find that when somebody tells you you're an atheist and you go, oh, okay, that's really interesting. And then they go, yeah, because the way I see it, like the universe is like, oh, okay, that's great. And then, yeah, because, you know, I know some people think there's a God. It's like, I find the most evangelistic people in the workplace are atheists, which is kind of interesting.
Sure.
But I think the people I know just think, you're kind of normal and you're kind of like us and you're a Christian. How does that work? And so I think a lot of people I work with, they just don't know any Christians, metropolitan elite. So I think that, yeah, they just find it odd. And they don't even know where to begin, what questions to even ask. And so they tend not to ask any. But that's okay, you know, and I try to make it as easy as possible for them, especially comedy writers, because they're really funny usually. And they are very good at making jokes at your expense. So I kind of make a joke at my own expense to give them permission to do that, because I don't care. I'm an idiot. So obviously being a Christian affects the way I write and it affects the way I behave. I want them to think well of Jesus because of me. I don't particularly care what they think of me. So I want to be, you know, I want to be good on deadlines. I want to be respectful. I want to be do my job as well as I can. I want to help other writers. I get involved in the Writers Guild a bit just to help writers get paid better and those sorts of things. Because it makes kind of more demands on me, I guess, to some extent. But the thing that I think is a really great advantage I have as a Christian in my line of work is writing comedy is hard. Getting a sitcom on TV is really hard. I got Bluestone on TV, and nobody saw it, but I got a show on. It took me ages to get a show on TV. I might not get another one on for another 10 years. It takes a long time. You know, I work on other shows, and that's great. But you have to work so hard and so believe in your idea and so want to do it that when you're rejected, which is normal, it's devastating. It's really hard work to do all this work, to write a script, to rewrite it, to get it up, to pass it on, to go, okay, they're going to do it, they're not going to do it.
Mm.
And you spent 2 years working on something and it's gone. Mm. And people find that really hard. And I think the reason is because they pour themselves into their work and they are their job. And they want that thing so much that they almost become that thing. As a Christian, my work is something I love to do and I delight in it, and I think God made me to do it. But my identity is not in my work. It is not in my achievements. It is not in winning a BAFTA or a Sony Award or getting a good review, anything like that. My identity is in Christ, and therefore I kind of don't mind about the rest. I'd like to be successful and make money, and I do okay. You know, some years are better than others. But when I get a no, which is normal, I can deal with it because I know that my value is not in my job, that my value is in Jesus, because he died on the cross for me, he made me, he loves me, and therefore I can kind of cope with everything else.
So let's finish on two questions. First one, who is Jesus to you today? If he enables you to have that sense of self that can survive the no's, what's so great about Jesus?
What I love about the Lord Jesus is, firstly, that he is a person and not an idea. He's not a concept. He's not a central plank of theology, although he is that. He is a person. If you've been born 2,000 years earlier, and you've been born slightly further southeast of here, about 2,000 miles southeast, you could have met him. You could have spoken to the Lord Jesus, through whom the entire universe was made. And I talk about that. I've got two kids, and I talk to them about how, when it'd be great to meet Jesus, and we will meet him one day, and that's great. And therefore, to think about him as a person, and therefore, when I read him in the Gospels, when I read the things that he says, I just find them really interesting and really, and the older I get, the more I realize I don't quite understand what he's talking about. As I get older, the parables become harder to understand and not easier to understand. And yet they've survived 2,000 years of scrutiny and conversation and academia and everything that's been thrown at it. And yet these parables, they stay with us. They are still touchstones for Western civilization. And, you know, the job I do as a sitcom writer, they're only parables, really. So I find I just love listening to what Jesus says. I don't listen as much as I should, but every time I do, I'm being treated as who I am now, not who I was or who I will be. I just feel God speaking to me through Jesus, that Jesus is speaking to me as I am now. And that's kind of weird, but it's kind of brilliant. And if you read the gospel for yourself, you will find that if you read it honestly and openly.
And I take it that would be your advice. So if people are here investigating into Christian faith themselves, what next steps would you recommend?
You could probably think of 10 reasons why you shouldn't become a Christian. You can probably think of, yeah, but what about this? And what about that? And what about tidal waves? What about Buddhists? What about, yeah, okay, they're all important to think about. What about you? What about Jesus? Who is he? You need to know who Jesus is. Because if he is who he claims to be, that's really big. There is no bigger thing. So I think my advice is to, sure, look into the questions that you have and the objections to the Christian faith, but read what Jesus says in the New Testament. Don't read stuff about him. Don't read opinions about him. Don't spend lots of time listening to people argue about him. You can read what he said in your own language. And for free, you know, you can get an app. You can get a Bible app. You can read it for free. But read it. Don't put it off. Don't think about, you know, reasons why you can't. Now's not a good time. It's never a good time. It's never the right time. But it's not about, you know, it's not about your time. It's about his time. So just read what it says. And if, you know, and I dare you just to say before you read, Jesus, who are you? Please show me. Just read what it says. And I'm afraid to say he will show you. So don't pray that prayer lightly, but it is important that you do it. All the other stuff is great to look into. Did he really rise from the dead? Did he do this? What about suffering? What about these? These are all important questions. But they're only worth investigating once you know who Jesus is. So I would get to know Jesus first, because he is where everything is. Wow, I said that so articulately, haven't I? You can tell I'm a writer. He is where everything is.
Yeah.
Great.
Ending on the verb. Poet.
Ending on the verb. Yeah, man. It's all wrong.
But that's solid gold advice, though.
Yeah. It is. Read what Jesus says. That's it.
Yeah. Brilliant. Brilliant advice. Ladies and gentlemen, let's give our appreciation to James Carey.